How old are you?
75.
Have you always lived in Sioux Falls here?
No, I grew up in Lead and went to college at Northern when it was Northern State Teachers College and met my husband there. He was from Sisseton. Then we worked for US West, Northwestern Bell and Quest and moved all over the state. So, but we've lived in this area for about 30 years.
Take me back to during World War II, when Pearl Harbor happened. Do you remember how old you were?
Well, I was born in 1932, so I was almost 10 years old. Lead was a very unique place to live at that time. It was very much the homestake was very paternalistic, took care of its workers. I think there was always this feeling that if you were true to the company would take care of you. There's disagreement on how well sometimes they took care of you, but there were many benefits. And my grandfather, on my mother's side of the family, they immigrated from Cornwall in England. They were miners, and so they were brought into the homestake, came to the homestake for work. And my grandfather's father, Charles Parsons, was one of the first legislators to South Dakota. But he was a foreman in the mine and went eventually to South Africa, was sent there by the mine interests to be foreman, mining foreman there. So on my mother's side of the family, we've all a long history of working for the homestake and working and living in Lead.
So you were there living in Lead when you were 10 years old, when Pearl Harbor.
When Pearl Harbor began, I can remember. Yes, of course, I was, and this is, I have to, I have to be a little careful because when you, what we, I remember may not be what other people remember, and so I'm giving you my memories of growing up in a very happy setting. The homestake was at that time was very much a family. Generations worked in the homestake. So it was a rather close-knit community, but a community of many, many different nationalities, which was unique. We could go down the street and there would be people speaking Slavonian languages, Italian languages, Finnish languages, English. And unfortunately, we did kind of stay in little conclaves in the city too, where nationality groups would cluster together because of the language problems. But it was still a very, very warm, very friendly place to live. I can remember my grandmother listening to Hitler on the radio and crying because she was an invalid and the radio was her only communication with the world. And she knew something terrible was going to happen. And I can remember the sound of his voice. It's like the newsreels that you hear, harsh and guttural, angry. And then a little bit later, my mother's youngest sister married a young man from Norway who immigrated. And he was there. And I can remember as a child watching him late at night listening to the shortwave radio trying to get news of his family in Norway when that country was invaded. So there are memories of World War II that are sporadic, but have been very much part of my reaction to things because of the heart, not understanding what was happening, but knowing that it was something very bad.
Do you remember how you felt when you would hear your grandma cry or see her cry listening to Hitler there?
I was the oldest of nine grandchildren, and we were very, very close. And it was disturbing, and the sadness of my uncle. And the family tried to keep we children from knowing too much, but you couldn't help but be concerned. And yet there was nothing immediate about any of it. I mean, it was something that was happening that was far away. News wasn't as quick as it is now, so we were isolated to a certain extent.
Do you remember how much you knew at that time about what was happening or who Hitler was?
We just knew Hitler. Well, if we went to Saturday morning serials, cowboy shows, there would be a short newsreel and there would be often pictures of him. But it was so far away. It just didn't seem to be, we knew who he was. It wasn't until the war actually broke out that we became very, very, very patriotic, and there was a lot of, a great deal of very deliberate coloring of news and censoring of news so that we were very much aware of the bad side, which was bad, but we were very much brainwashed into a really hatred of everything that Hitler or Hirohito stood for. And interesting now as adults to look back and see how biased the news was and how we accepted it so easily. But we were at the very risky time of our history too.
And when you say biased within the news media, as I understand, there was nothing negative that was put out about the American government. It was all
No.
positive.
Well, and it was, I know years later, my nephew, who's now 50 years old, but he was watching as a high school student, I think, an old cartoon that was, they still hadn't taken it off KELO, and it was a picture story about a cartoon making fun of the Japanese, and such a caricature of big glasses, senseless activity, stupid people. I mean, and he was appalled by what was, but that was the way we were, that was the kind of cartooning we were given, in almost animalistic types of behavior on the part of but I at the same time, in defense, we weren't sure that the war was going to go our way, and they had to organize. I mean, we had to be very much in an organized society, or we might not have survived had it actually come to our country.
Do you remember how you felt? Did you have strong feelings personally about the Japanese or Nazi Germans?
No. I think because we lived in a community of so many different nationalities that it wasn't like in the eastern part of the state where the people from German people from Eureka and that area were ostracized. There was very little of that that I'm aware of, and I think part of it was just the kind of little United Nations that lead was at that time. You know, people all, and it was a single industry town, so everybody worked together. At that time, there was a parochial school, but most children went to the same high school, so that there was a unity even, you know, all the way through. It was like an extended family in many ways.
You had mentioned how your grandma and your uncle were very sad at the time. Did that continue throughout the war, or did they?
Unfortunately, my grandmother died before right in, I think, November, before Pearl Harbor, and we know that she would not have, she was so physically weak that she would not have been able to endure the war. It really emotionally affected her. And my uncle, they left to go to work in other mines during the war. That is the perhaps the thing I wanted to talk about, because most people weren't aware of the unless you were there or had a reason to remember it, when the Homestake miners were very highly skilled hard rock miners, and the mine itself was relatively safe, but the contract miners were very, very, as I said, were very skilled. But when the war broke out, and we've never done, have never experienced this since, and probably never did before, everything, the federal government had unusual war powers. And because the Homestake, with the gold, its primary product, it was considered a non-essential industry, and so it was closed. And yet there was no question, it was simply closed. And the men were, and I don't know if they were given help to move, or I have a feeling there had to be some guarantee for them, or how could they leave? But they had no jobs. They kept on a very small crew. My dad had lost his eye in a mine accident, so he was kept on, and the mine was kept in operating order by a group of men that stayed with the company. But most of the men were given jobs in Leadville, Colorado, or Wallace, Idaho, Coeur d'Alene, where there were vital industry ores that they could mine. They were guaranteed a job to come back to. And the sad part is that there was no one to buy the houses or rent the houses, so many of them had to just simply board up their homes and leave. I remember probably one of the first things that I consciously remembered was the quietness of Lead, because all my life the mill had run 24 hours a day and there was that sound always. And then the mill was shut and it was quiet and the town was quiet. The homestake was self-contained so that it had a foundry, it had a machine shop, it had a blacksmith shop, woodworking, sawmill, all of these industries, and anything that could be converted to wartime production, like the foundry made grenade casings by the hundreds of millions. They just poured out machine the grenade casings. The blacksmith shop, the machine shop. My uncle was a master machinist, and they did fine tooling. And so there was, and they were frozen. The term was frozen. If you were in a vital industry, you could not just leave it arbitrarily. You had to go to another, you could go to another place, but it had to also be a wartime vital industry. So they were, the men who were there were not considered for the draft, for example. They were vital for the war report, production.
Were
And
women also
women were
used?
not employed in any other area of, except office work in the homestake. But it was interesting because my mother was it was a unique, adventurous soul. And they had a mica plant that came in where they split the mica. So she split, she and a group of women worked in the mica plant during, that was something new. And women didn't work outside the home very much. And then there was a time that they peeled logs, and they would bring in these huge spruce and pine logs, and then people would have to use a draw knife and take the bark off. And that was also considered, I don't know whatever happened to the logs, but that was considered a vital industry too, some way. And we did goofy things like saved all of our grease, and we either made soap ourselves, or you could send the grease someplace, and it was supposed to be a basis for nitroglycerin. I don't know, but that was what we were told. And we would have scrap metal drives. And behind, if you lived on the right side of the hill, so that your backyard was on the hill and your house looked out over the valley, you could dig a little dugout in the back. That's where you put your garbage or your dump things. And almost every neighborhood had two or three of these funny little dump sites that would eventually be covered over. And there was not any metal left in any of those sites because we would have a scrap iron drive, and people would go rummaging around in those old dugouts and bring out stoves and cast iron things, and it would all be sent off to be made into recast and made into metal. I'm not sure what they ever used it for. Somebody told me one time that a lot of it was busy work to keep us feeling that we were part of the war effort, that much of it was never really utilized, but we worked hard at it. And but don't plan on going out and digging around in the hills and finding antiques, because they're all gone.
Did you feel like you were helping the war effort?
Yes, we bought boards, we bought saving stamps in school. We had drives and contests, and there was a high degree of patriotism. The National Guard from the area was one of the first units that were mobilized, and those young men went to they were from Lead. I believe most of them were in transportation trucking, and they went to across North Africa and up the peninsula of Italy, and fought at places like Cassino and Monte Carlo, and that extreme, well, Ernie Pyle was wrote of their work during the war. And then those young men came home, and just more or less got their lives reorganized, and they were all called back for the Korean War. I often thought of how their lives were so interrupted in so many ways, and how sad that was. But they were one of the first units that went. So there were not a lot of young men. People ask about skiing, and you have to have strong young men to ski. And there just simply weren't. And so skiing in the hills didn't, for a time before the war, there were a lot of skiing done. Then the ski lifts were shut down, and it wasn't until after the war that people began skiing in a recreational way. People would still ski, but it was more individual and not the sport that we think of now.
And they didn't ski because they weren't there.
They simply weren't there.
If there is such a heavy concentration of men in lead working for Homestake, were there a lot that went over to fight in the war from the community?
There were there, as I said before, it was such a company town and such a family. It seemed to be a very family-oriented industry, and so you were when you talk we did there was not a great deal of I don't remember people moving in and out of Lead a great deal until after the war. And after the war, when those other mines, the production was more limited because of it, the war effort was over. Then Lead was just inundated with people looking for work again. Lead didn't really have the same kind of depression that the rest of the state had. If you had a job in Lead, you did well. And there were always young men coming to Lead during the Depression, like my dad. He came from a farm family in around Aberdeen, and he got a job. And then, if I understood, I was too little to know, but that his brothers and people from the Mallette area would come and sleep on the floor in the kitchen until they could, as they call it, rustle a job with the Homestake, or else they moved on. So it was an area where if you had a job, you were doing well. And Ali did not suffer the same kind of depression that, but I remember sadly things like there would be signs on doors that would say no dogs allowed, and that would be hobos or people, vagrants going through. There were a lot of things that were not politically correct that were sad that happened. The Homestake had not only, I mean, it was such a Miss Phoebe Hearst, from the Hearst family. The Hearst family had major interest in the Homestake, and Lead became one of her pet charity projects. And we had we called the recreation building, and it's still there. I think it's a museum now, but at that time, in this little town of Lead, out in the wilderness, more or less, we had the Homestake Opera House, and Jenny Lind was supposed to have come and sung at the Opera House. And it was a beautiful, beautiful building. I can remember as a child sitting under the a huge chandelier, well, it'd be more than a chandelier, but this huge lighted fixture above, and wondering what would happen if that ever fell. It would kill us all. And that, unfortunately, that with frescoes on the wall and box seats, and it was just elegant, elegant, elegant. And it became a theater, and then now it just went downhill, and we didn't have the foresight to that those things should have been kept, that they should have been protected. They've tried, but I think there was a major fire not too long ago. But in that recreation building was a library, an indoor swimming pool, bowling, I think 3 lanes, bowling lanes, and a recreational level with pool tables, and all of that was free to any Homestake employee, as well as a hospital where you got complete medical care down to band-aids if you wanted to get your doctor to write a prescription, and complete for the family, for the employee and the family. And Lead always was a little bit snobbish. They were a little bit above. Of course, we were above everybody else.
Literally with the elevation, right.
Literally, we were a mile high, but we looked down upon Deadwood. Deadwood, all kinds of evil things went on down there, like the Purple Door and Ladies of the Night and gambling. Lead would never do anything like that. Lead just went down there to do it, but nobody was supposed to know that. And I think it made it an interesting place to grow up because there was a kind of a society type of attitude in a lot of things. There was a lot of class structure in Lead. And if you were one of the families, even if you weren't wealthy, that was better than to be like first generation, second generation. If you had been there for a period of time, that was, you had a higher status. Of course, the general manager had a beautiful mansion, just a magnificent home on the top of the hill. And my uncle, great uncle, was the gardener, and they raised all of their own flowers year round. They had roses and she, Mrs. Hurst, was Episcopalian, and she donated money for the Episcopalian church to be built in Lead with the one condition that there always would be kindergarten for the children who could come. So we had free kindergarten for 4 and 5 years old. All you had to do was be able to walk there, which limited the number of children who could come because there were no cars. But I know I had 2 years of kindergarten and then went into first grade. And that was a gift from Mrs. Hurst to the community. And in many ways, we were really babied by, we were almost like a little pet project for people. And but it was interesting and good. But it was fun to walk down the street and hear the different languages and the different grocery stores. We always went to Pavlovich's store, and that was basically Slavonian, the Sandviches, and Mr. Papa Pavlovich owned it at that time. And it was such a funny place. It had a little wooden stove in the back, and the men would gather around and chew tobacco and talk in all different languages. And Papa would say, "Oh," and he'd pull out a salami and he'd tell my mother, he'd say, "Just smell that. That smells so good. Mrs. Palmer, you should just, And someone said, "How can you go there? There's that cat that's walking all over the food." Well, the cat was there to get rid of the mice. So, and mother said, "Oh, I never thought of that." But all of the places, there was no government bureau that was going to make a health inspection. It was just neat people. And there was a Wiley's store that I think where basically Finnish people went to, and up the street was Italian people, and they would have many ethnic foods that were. And I can remember the lutefisk being the sides of cod stacked up like wood outside the grocery stores, in the cold weather, and it was just hard as rock. And like someone often wondered what happened if if there was a dog in the neighborhood, you didn't want to eat that lutefisk. But no, it didn't seem to kill any Norwegians, so it was all right. It was just fun. It was fun.
Is there something that you remember most distinctly that you would do often to support the war effort or something during that time from your about 10 to about 15 or so when the war ended? Something that you guys, you and maybe your cousins and brothers and sisters did together.
Well, the most things that I can remember are things connected with the rationing, and that was we knew that like shoes, you only had so many pair of shoes a year. You had ration stamps, and sometimes the soles of the shoes would be just like cardboard. They would be, and how we all had those little kits where we'd resole them ourselves at home, where we'd because they weren't even well enough made to take them to the shoemaker. But my dad's mine shoes, they would, they could be repaired. And My mother, my dad was a heavy meat eater, working hard, and so her sister was more like to do home canning, so they would share meat stamps for sugar stamps and back and forth, and we kids never begrudged it, but Dad was the only one who had bacon in the morning, but that was early before we were up to go to school, but he needed it, and but. And then the other big thing was my folks just happened to buy a 41 Studebaker, so they had a new car for a long time, and you could only drive 35 miles an hour, and your tires were very limited, so you wouldn't have driven much more than that anyway. And my aunt and lived down in a little farm outside of Sturgis. And we had 35 miles an hour. It took us an hour or more to get to Sturgis. And we didn't have a radio in the car. That was a luxury. So my dad and mother would sing to us going down to what the time away. And I remember one of the songs my dad used to sing was about a miner. A miner was going to his work one day when he heard his little girl scream, "Daddy, oh daddy, don't go away. I had such a terrible dream." And then, of course, the chorus was to, "Daddy, don't go to the mine today, for dreams have so often come true. Daddy, my daddy, don't go away. I never could live without you." And last night I dreamed that the mine was a fire, and the miners all fought for their lives. Just then the scene changed, and the mouth of the mine was covered with sweethearts and wives. "Go down to the village and tell your dear friends that it sure is the bright stars do shine, that something will happen today at the mine. Daddy, don't go to the mine." Well, that was the end of the song, as far as we knew, but we three children could not have it. That could not be the end. We had to have an ending, so my dad would have to then sing several verses that he would make up on the spot to reassure us that she'd know he never would go if her dear. If she had such a terrible, no, she was fine. No, because I remember my dad seldom, if ever, went to work without us, all of the family kissing him, because it was dangerous, and that was part of it. And we would drive down to Spearfish, or to Sturgis, and there was one little gas station, Mr. Termus, who would sometimes slip you a few extra gallons of gas, but you had to have gas coupons to, and some, in order to get any gas at all. But Mr. Termus, for some reason, had taken a liking to my dad, and he would black market gas here and there, and it was, and there'd be funny things. The stores would get an influx of like Jell-O. Now, why would Jell-O? Nobody liked Jell-O that well, and people would hoard Jell-O. At the end of the war, there might be 50 boxes of Jell-O in there, but it was something, you made cake out of Jell-O, you improvised. But with my brother and sister, they were just 14 months apart, or 15, 16 months apart, and they were just little imps. And they broke out in this terrible rash, and the doctor came. They made house calls, and he said that it was scarlet fever, so the house was quarantined. And I was at a slumber party, or not at home anyway, so I stayed at my aunt's. My dad was at work, so he had to stay at one of the other relatives' homes because we couldn't go to the house. And the mother would call in the groceries, and the delivery boy would bring them up to the front step. And then he'd run fast. And then mother would look around. If nobody was there, she could go out and get the groceries and bring them in. And dad would sit on the porch, on the wall, and mother would go out on the porch. And that was as much communication as they had for 2 weeks. And Jim and Charlie were just as healthy as two little kids could be. They were in 2 weeks in that house without any break. My poor mother almost lost her mind. They jumped on furniture. So finally, the quarantine was over, and everybody was so happy. And about a week later, they broke out in the same rash again. Well, the doctor said it can't be scarlet fever, but it was the food coloring that was in candy. that was highly, some children had a high allergy to it. So there was nothing, oh, the food was, I mean, substitution for sugars and things were, you really had some strange food.
Give me some examples of some of the strange things, like the
Well, I mean,
jello and.
well, one interesting thing, at that time, salmon, now tuna fish is the everyday meat, canned meat for us. I mean, most of it, salmon is quite expensive. But for some reason, it was just the reverse then. We were at my, across the valley at my grandmother's home where my Aunt Clara was, and she opened a can of salmon for cream salmon, and it was filled with glass shards, ground glass. And we called the FBI immediately, and we never heard any more. But whether that was, we were sure it was the work of the Axis powers that were somehow had gotten in and was polluting our food supply. We never heard one way or another, and it very easily could have been sabotage of some kind for some reason.
Did the U.S. at the time get any food from overseas at all, or was it
No,
mostly
it
homegrown?
was mo we most lead it was so high, we the elevation, we couldn't grow, we didn't have victory gardens. But down in the valleys there, most people had raised a lot of their own vegetables and butchered their own animals. Lead was very isolated. Prices were always so high for things like oranges and anything that was brought in. I mean, it was there were it, I can't say that it was hardship in that way, but because everybody was in the same situation, so you just simply that's the way life was. But it was a time of sacrifice for parents, I think, more than we kids. We didn't realize it was anything different. That's we never lived in a different time. I remember the movies were very propaganda filled. They were very, very brutal, some of them.
When you say brutal, do you mean showing brutality
Well,
or towards the enemy?
just very coarse, maybe would be, I mean, very, they, of course, not in the way our movies are now, where they're explicit, but we're very, very blunt in the treatment of other people. It could have fostered a lot of ethnic. I can see why that in California that they allowed the Japanese to be interned, because you can shape people's minds so easily.
Do you think it shaped you at all being exposed to that? If you look at how you feel now towards the Japanese, or maybe a reaction when you see a Japanese or an Asian person, has that affected you at all? Just being exposed to that propaganda?
I'm trying to remember. I was very embarrassed, and a very I'm a very liberal person, and I think there were many instances where I was embarrassed and didn't understand, even as a young person, the kind of treatment that people were subjected to. And I can remember the pictures of the Japanese, and they weren't as those who are going into the camps. I don't think there was the same. There was a question as to why that had to be, because you saw these people, and then they made quite an issue in several movies of showing those men, the Japanese American men who enlisted, and they became highly decorated. Their units were highly decorated, and that was quite well publicized. And you didn't have that same feeling toward the German people, because I suppose because we look the same. I don't know why it would be, but we didn't. It wasn't the same feeling that. But I remember how confusing it was, because why if they were Americans did they have to go into camps just because they looked different? And that was bothered me from for a long time as a child.
Do you remember how your parents felt? I mean, were they the same as you, the same liberal viewpoint and the same questioning, or?
No, my mother was, she, I would not say she was prejudiced, I mean bigoted, but she did not always trust those people. People who were different, maybe perhaps more Hispanic, Indian,
Different colored
different
skin.
color, yeah. And my dad was far more accepting of people.
Did Leeds see a lot of deaths, a lot of soldiers killed over there? Do you recall a lot of grieving mothers or parents at all
Well, I
in town?
remember the stars in the window. My mother's, my great aunt, all five of her sons were in the service. And what a tragedy that was. It was after the Sullivan brothers were all killed in the one ship that they weren't going to take all five of the boys. They drafted four, and one was given exemption because he was in college, but he couldn't take the ostracism. They would look at him. He was healthy. Why aren't you where you should be? And he couldn't say, well, four of my brothers are already, so all five of the Morecambe boys were in the service in various theaters of action. And my Aunt Clara that I spoke of before was a farm, came from a farm down by Sturgis, and they actually asked Mr. Twite which of his two sons they could draft. He had two sons. One of them would be considered vital, and because of branching. But if they had to take, which one would he let go, and how? He just said he couldn't do that. But
I could imagine
there,
making that sort of
no,
choice. That the five, you said Malcolm,
Morecambe.
Morecambe, did they all come back?
Yes,
Oh, they did.
there were some boys that were lost, and but when the National Guard came back, that was such a celebration because they came back as a group, and it was really, I can remember, I don't remember VE Day as vividly as VJ Day because there was still the war going on, and so many of the men were in the Pacific. But I was probably a freshman in high school, and someone had a pickup truck and loaded a group of us, and we cheered and waved flags and banners and things, and went down through Deadwood and back up through Leeds, and it was quite a celebration. And
Was that for VJ or was that for the National Guard
that was
going
for
home?
VJ Day
Okay.
when we got that, and there was a big dance at the pavilion up in the park. We're celebrating, and
Do you remember how you got the news?
I didn't hear it. I suppose I was downtown, and someone came with the pickup and said, "The war is over, the war is over." And so we just jumped on the truck and away we went. But there, I was not of an age where the boys my age were being drafted, and so there it didn't touch me. And the senior boys were all planning on going, but many of them didn't have to go, but they were all planning on going, and so there it was coming to me, but it wasn't really part of my life yet.
Do you think you said how happy you were and how happy everybody was when the war ended? Do you think that was because there was a sense of relief? Maybe since your age group, you weren't going to have to experience having your classmates going overseas, or what do you think it was that made you so happy?
Well, just the fact that it wasn't even after D-Day. We never really felt absolutely sure that we were going to win the war. I think there was always a concern that maybe something would go wrong, and so it wasn't until it was completely over, and then we knew that the homestake would open again, and my cousin and that family who left didn't come back, but they stayed, and we visited back and forth, but it was never they never returned. But many, many, many families came back to the homestake. And then it changed. The company changed, and it didn't have. Oh, I was. You ask about attitudes, and I was trying to remember what it was. The Homestake had a hotel. It had the big, that Tennessee Ernie Ford song, 16 ton. That was really true. That's what the men were expected to. Each day they were expected to produce that much rock, and. Another line was, and they owe their soul to the company store, and it was true too. The Hearst Mercantile Company was a huge store, and if you owed money, your check went to the store, and then you went down and got what was left over, and it was a magnificent store. I mean, we really were so lucky because it should have been a little, a little struggling town, and instead we had all of these things given to us. But the one of the was the hotel, where it was very plush, and that's where people stayed who had connections. And I remember that Marian Anderson came to sing in the area, and she was not given a room. And that was one of my first moments of indignation as a liberal, that our town would turn her away. That stayed with me for a long time. But it was a Republican town, so it was very conservative. And
Like most of West River is
it most,
today, sure.
yeah.
Do you remember after the war? Did everything just all of a sudden everything was better and life was great? No more sugar rationing, no
Yeah.
more.
It didn't take as long as you think it might for all that to change. It took longer to get tires for the cars and things, and for new cars to come. But it just seemed like once the men started coming back, that life just expanded and expanded, and the town itself. Like I say, we had been so insular. My grandfather was foreman of the foundry. He had begun working in the Homestake when he was 14, carrying water to the men. And then he became foreman of the foundry. My uncle was a master machinist. My dad worked underground. My brother went to school of mines and never did work regularly for the Homestake, but he was guaranteed summer work as long as he had his ties to the Homestake. The Homestake took care of their own. And after the war, then the union sentiment became stronger. The new people coming in didn't have the same relationship with the company that they had been. The company became more bottom line conscious and were not as giving. The Hearst influence wasn't as powerful. And the town definitely changed. It became, I think Lawrence County at one time had one of the highest crime and juvenile. Problems of the state, and it was a lot of it was mouth to mouth living, from day to day, from paycheck to paycheck, and a different attitude than it had been when it was a company town and a family town. Much different town that I graduated high school was much different from when I went into first grade.